Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst David McMichael, who assesses the findings of the Presidential Commission established to investigate the failure of intelligence leading up to the Iraq War. Dr. Helen Caldicott, anti-nuclear activist and founder of the Nobel Prize-winning Physicians for Social Responsibility, who discusses the dangers of global nuclear weapons proliferation and the militarization of outer space. And Kevin Camps of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, who examines the safety concerns his group has in establishing radioactive waste storage sites around the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On April 1st, hundreds of anti-immigration activists gathered in Tombstone, Arizona, the site of the 1881 gunfights at the OK Corral, for a month-long unofficial tour of duty along the border with Mexico. The Minuteman Project, which blames the federal government inaction for the influx of illegal immigrants, has set up patrols of six people each to search for undocumented immigrants crossing the border in the hot Arizona desert. The volunteers, labeled vigilantes by critics, will wear improvised uniforms and be equipped with shortwave radios and night sights as they patrol a 23-mile stretch of the border. According to the London-based Guardian newspaper, the Minuteman Project does not want its volunteers to confront the immigrants, but to call the U.S. Border Patrol. T.J. Bonner, the head of the union representing U.S. Border Patrol agents, is uneasy about the new citizen patrols. He said, "It's a dangerous place down there. It's the Wild West reincarnated." Robin Hoover, head of Human Borders, a group that leaves water for immigrants crossing the desert, sees the potential for violence between the well-armed citizen patrols and dangerous drug smugglers as they attempt to cross the border. The news magazine In These Times reports that campaign finance reformers in Congress are going after politically powerful independent 527 groups like America Coming Together and Progress for America. In early February, Arizona Republican Senator John McCain and Wisconsin Democratic Senator Russ Feingold introduced the 527 Reform Act of 2005 that would require these groups to register as political committees with the Federal Election Commission and obey the soft money ban passed by Congress. According to the Center for Public Integrity, federal 527 groups raised over $246 million during the 2004 presidential election cycle through media campaigns, voter registration drives, and get-out-the-vote efforts. The 527 reform bill also seeks to limit individual contributions to $5,000 if the group is only working on federal elections. The Center for Public Integrity's Aaron Pilhofer says regulating the 527 groups may actually make it harder to track the influence of big money in national politics. The bill is also facing criticism from political advocacy groups like the Alliance for Justice, the League of Conservation Voters, and NARAL Pro-Choice America for what they claim to be a restriction on free speech rights of nonprofit groups. Rogue police officers in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, are being blamed for a bloody massacre that killed 30 people in an apparent payback for an investigation into police corruption and brutality. Two shootings occurred on March 31st in Rio's crime-ridden suburbs 20 miles north of the city. Innocent civilians were killed outside a car wash and near a neighborhood bar. The ages of the dead ranged from a 13-year-old teenager to a 64-year-old. Claudia Guerrero, a spokeswoman for the Rio Public Safety Department, stated, "There are strong indications that the massacres could be seen as a reprisal for the arrest of eight officers suspected of killing two men." Jorge Pisciani, president of the Rio de Janeiro State Assembly, who went to the funeral of the massacre victims, observed, "Experience has shown that this type of crime is always carried out by the underworld of the police apparatus." In a statement, Amnesty International said this is the worst case of police violence since the 1993 massacre of street children as they lay sleeping in front of a church in Rio. As Amnesty concluded, "Any hopes that such actions were horrors of the past have been dashed, which shows what great lengths death squads will go to spread terror and resist attempts to stop their activities." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
The Bush administration's repeated assertion that Saddam Hussein possessed dangerous weapons of mass destruction served as the pretext for their 2003 war against Iraq. But after the invasion and an exhaustive search, the alleged arsenal of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons were never found. In the midst of a heated election campaign, the White House established a presidential commission to conduct a limited investigation into the intelligence failures leading up to the war. The commission, led by Judge Lawrence Silberman and former Senator Charles Robb, predictably found serious flaws in the operation of the nation's intelligence agencies, but made no judgments on how the president and his cabinet used or misused the information it received about Iraq's weapons programs. Critics contend that the administration had a long-standing plan for launching an invasion of Iraq, regardless of what the intelligence agencies produced. The panel made recommendations for the reorganization of the nation's 15 intelligence agencies, but offered no view on holding accountable those responsible for what many view as the most serious intelligence failure in U.S. history. The Bush administration's promotion and honoring of key officials answerable for the flawed intelligence provides insight into the priorities of a White House seemingly uninterested in accountability. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst David McMichael, who assesses the findings of the presidential commission and the importance of learning the truth about why our nation went to war.
I concluded a piece I recently published on this by saying that if I were a Michelin Guide reviewer, I'd give this report one star at best. And the reason I say that is because it's well-written, I think quite well-researched, in exposing what to people who follow this are certainly well-known weaknesses within the United States intelligence system in the way it handles information. And it does give a lot of specifics about particularly the foul-ups dealing with the supposed Iraq weapons of mass destruction, but it uses this as a buildup to essentially argue that the presidential decision, this administration's decision to invade Iraq, was largely because a naive and misinformed executive branch was misled about the threat posed by these what we now know to be non-existent weapons of mass destruction. And, of course, this simply does not hold up. For example, the reports of Saddam's son-in-law, Mustafa Kemal, who defected in 1995, had been checked out completely by the then UN inspection teams within Iraq and by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and were found to be correct, so that even the title of the report and so forth on weapons of mass destruction is misleading. And we also know from such indisputable sources as former U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill that the administration had determined to go to war with Iraq from the day of its very first cabinet meeting. So this is all very unconvincing. And then I think what really disappointed me in this, and I think I know enough of Judge Silberman's background not to have expected too much from him, but I'd hope for a little better from Senator Robb and certainly some of the other commissioners when they argue very seriously as to what use or misuse the administration may have made of the intelligence reporting. That certainly wasn't in their purview. As a matter of fact, they couldn't do it. And, of course, they failed to note that their charter was, in fact, presented to them by President Bush, who, let us say, was probably not eager to have that question raised or answered. So to me, it's the further part of the general cover-up, which has been going on through more than one administration in dealing with Iraq.
In one press report that summarized the Presidential Commission conclusions here, it said, on one of the most delicate questions raised by the Iraqi intelligence failure, the report said, quote, "The analysts who worked the Iraqi weapons issue universally agreed that in no instance did political pressure cause them to skew or alter any of their analytical judgments," basically saying that there was no political pressure. What do you think?
Well, I work with a group called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And quite a number of the members of our group are people who were either within the intelligence system at this time, at the CIA or in the Defense Intelligence Agency, or in other positions. And I checked with all of these people, all of whom have argued vociferously and publicly that, in fact, they were exposed to political pressure. And not one of these individuals was contacted by the commission. One of these, by the way, whose name is very public, is Greg Thielman, who was the authority at INR, that is the State Department's Office of Intelligence and Research, who argued most vociferously against the nuclear program data being presented. And Greg was not contacted, nor was Karen Kwiatkowski, the Air Force, now retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, who had very publicly described the pressures put on her office in the Department of Defense by this so-called Office of Special Plans that was initiated by Doug Faith in the Department of Defense. And that, frankly, does not hold up.
How do you think citizens of this country and the world will ever really know the truth about the motivation for this war?
We look to 1998, when the United States Congress, at the urging of the Clinton administration, passes the Iraq Liberation Act, which says that our policy is to remove the Saddam Hussein regime. Madeleine Albright, our Secretary of State at the time, when presented with and commenting on the evidence that there were no weapons of mass destruction in the Iraq of the mid-1990s, and other countries were saying, okay, it's time to remove the sanctions. And she said, and I'm quoting, "We do not agree with those nations who argue that if Iraq complies with its obligations concerning weapons of mass destruction, that sanctions should be lifted." Well, I mean, what you have here, and I'm trying to emphasize this, is a long, ongoing policy, which I think has been wrong-headed in very many ways, specifically in the case of Iraq, to remove that government, which was holding that very fractious country together by brutal means, I will acknowledge. But it had nothing to do, very frankly, with any threat posed by a country of 22 million which had no nuclear weapons, and after the mid-1990s, very, very limited conventional military force at all. I don't think intelligence, in the narrow sense, had anything to do with it.
That was former CIA analyst David McMichael. Read his article about the Presidential Commission on Intelligence Failures online by visiting the Foreign Policy in Focus website at www.fpif.org. The Bush administration has taken a hard line against nations they say are engaged in the development of nuclear weapons. Targets of harsh rhetoric coming from the White House include Iran and North Korea, countries that Mr. Bush has branded the axis of evil. But while the Bush administration speaks out frequently about the dangers of nuclear proliferation around the world, it has announced plans to spend millions of dollars to develop and test a new generation of American nuclear weapons and technology to militarize outer space. These include new bunker buster bombs, anti-satellite weapons, and anti-ballistic missiles as part of the National Missile Defense Program. Talks to renew the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, or NPT, begin in May, but the Bush administration and other nuclear powers are reported to be unconcerned about its fate. If the NPT is abandoned, its demise could pave the way for an unprecedented explosion of nuclear weapons proliferation across the globe. Dr. Helen Caldicott is a pediatrician and anti-nuclear weapons activist. She founded the Nobel Prize-winning Physicians for Social Responsibility in 1978 because of her grave concern over the medical impact of nuclear weapons on the human race. Caldicott, who went on to found the Nuclear Policy Research Institute in 2002, was nominated for the Nobel Prize for her efforts. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Caldicott about the current danger of nuclear weapons proliferation and the U.S. effort to militarize outer space.
The administration has used 9/11 to say that, well, we probably need some more nuclear weapons. This plan was actually initiated during the Clinton era, and they are currently designing, developing, and testing, about to test new nuclear weapons, up to 80 a year. Therefore, North Korea looks at America and says, well, if you're doing it, we will too. So it gives a very unfortunate message to the rest of the world. And unfortunately, America leads the world in the development of nuclear weapons and always has and is the model for the whole world. And people in glass houses can't throw stones. As Jesus said, I see not the mote in the other person's eye, look instead for the mote in your own eye. And so America can't, with impunity, tell other countries it can't have nuclear weapons when it's building more and has an arsenal of over 10,000 itself. I see the solution to this terribly detrimental problem being that Russia and America are now friends. They're fighting the terrorist issue together, and that if Russia and America decide to, they could within 5 years eradicate and abolish their nuclear arsenals. Of the 30,000 bombs in the world, Russia and America own 95% of them. So if they move towards abolition rapidly, then France, China and England have said they will too. And Israel, which has over probably 300 to 400 hydrogen bombs, and India and Pakistan would be forced to do the same. And then we could enter an era of relative nuclear sanity in the world. And I can think of no other issue more serious and pertinent now for us to address than this issue, which hangs over our head like the sword of Damocles twisting in the wind.
Dr. Caldicott, your group, which you founded back in 2002, the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, is sponsoring a conference in Washington, D.C. This May. The focus of that conference will be the weaponization of space. Tell us your concerns overall about the Bush administration and where they're headed with a revival of the Reagan-era Star Wars program and weaponizing space.
Okay, the conference I've organized is called Full Spectrum Dominance, which is the term that the U.S. Space Command uses to put weapons in space and to fight war in space and to fight war from space down to Earth and literally vaporize cities and, quotes, affect very many kills. They are intent on anti-satellite weapons, and they're building them right now. And the two companies who are most involved in this are Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. Missile defense is supposedly contrived to knock out Russia's missiles when they launch them. However, Russia can launch 2,500 hydrogen bombs all at once, and all tests that have been conducted thus far for missile defense in America where a hit-to-kill vehicle is hitting a dummy warhead have all failed and have all been fraudulent. It will never work, according to all of the physicists and scientists who are involved, and it's going to suck up to $1 trillion in money from the American taxpayers. That's a different system to putting actual weapons in space and launching war from space down to Earth. America plans to actually dominate space, and space is a global commons according to the United Nations law. It belongs to all of us, not just 5% of the Earth's population. So this is an absolute violation of international law. It could, in fact, trigger a nuclear war, as could the National Missile Defense Plans, because Russia and China have both said, if you build a missile defense system against our missiles, which are targeted on you, we'll just build thousands more hydrogen bombs so we can supersaturate your system. Incidentally, China only has 18 weapons that can hit America. So at this point in time, she's really not involved in the nuclear arms race, although the Pentagon is being very provocative and pushing her in that direction because it's all good for business, you see.
Where does citizen activism come in to this very bleak world where international law seems to be pushed aside by the Bush administration and setting an example for the rest of the world, treaty after treaty, whether it's global warming or nuclear nonproliferation or biological or chemical weapons treaties, seem to be, again, being ignored or decimated by the world's remaining superpower, the United States. Where do you have hope that things can change, Dr. Caldicott?
The Earth is in the intensive care unit. We have an acute clinical emergency on our hands like we did in the early 80s when Reagan got into office. And there's an aphorism which says, in a dark time, the eye begins to see. And this is a very, very dark time. I believe in the wisdom and intelligence of the American people. I believe they will do the right thing. And we just have to now get off our chairs and decide that we will save the Earth and in 5 years move towards bilateral nuclear disarmament with Russia. I know it can be done. I know I've spoken to millions of Americans. I know how they think and feel. They desperately want to do the right thing.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott, author of The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, published by The New Press. Contact Dr. Caldicott's Nuclear Policy Research Institute at area code 202-822-9800 or visit their website at www.nuclearpolicy.org. Headlines last week disclosed the debate between the National Academy of Sciences and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission about the best way to store high-level radioactive waste until it can be moved to a permanent storage site. For years, the government has moved forcefully to establish Yucca Mountain in Nevada as the nation's permanent nuclear waste repository. But recent news stories have revealed potential problems with the Yucca Mountain site, including fabricated test reports. Environmentalists and state officials in Nevada have long opposed the construction of the Yucca Waste site. The Yucca Mountain project is now years behind schedule, and waste keeps building up on site at nuclear plants around the U.S. 24 plants have moved some of their radioactive fuel waste into dry cask storage. The nuclear industry says it has a redundant layered safety system to prevent accidents or terrorist attacks, but opponents point to several close calls since the near meltdown at Pennsylvania's Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in 1979. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kevin Camps, who heads the radioactive waste project for the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. He outlined some of his group's concerns about the safety of temporary storage facilities at the power plants and at an Indian reservation in Utah that may soon be approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
High-level radioactive waste is not safe no matter where it's located, but there are considerations that perhaps it is safer in dry cask storage than in pools. And the reason for that is that pools require ongoing cooling. And there are moving parts, there are cooling pumps, and the water in the pools has to be there. And that's the threat from the pools, is if the water is lost or if the cooling pumps stop working for whatever reason, whether it be an accident or a terrorist attack or even a loss of electricity, then it's only a matter of time before the waste in the pools could actually go up in flames and cause a massive catastrophic radiation release. And the difference with the dry casks is there are no moving parts. It's air circulation, natural convection currents that cool the waste. But dry casks also have their vulnerabilities. They're vulnerable to accidents. They're vulnerable to terrorist attacks. Another, I guess, advantage of dry casks is that the waste is not all located in one place like in the pools. It's highly compacted in the pools, very close together. So much so at some reactors that it's approaching the concentration that you find in reactor cores. So there's even the danger of an inadvertent nuclear chain reaction in waste pools. But the same thing can happen in dry casks. So those are some of the dilemmas that we face with high-level radioactive waste.
So do you advocate one form of storage over the other? It sounds like it's better to move the waste into dry cask storage.
There have been a litany of problems with dry cask storage across the United States in the past 20 years that it's been used. It really is a dilemma. I mean, the first thing that we always try to say is we have to stop generating high-level radioactive waste because the amount in the United States is going to double or triple just in the next few decades if these reactors are allowed to keep operating and if new ones are built. But there is that question of what to do with the 50,000 tons of high-level radioactive waste that already exists in the United States, and that's the dilemma, because there has never been found anywhere on the planet at this point a place where this stuff can be buried, where it will not leak back out into the environment, because it's deadly forever. Literally, there are radioisotopes in the waste that are hazardous for millions, tens of millions, and if you consider uranium-238, for billions of years into the future.
Problems with burying the waste at Yucca Mountain have surfaced again recently, and now there's a move to put the waste on the Skull Valley Goshute Indian Reservation in Utah. Could Skull Valley just take the place of Yucca Mountain?
The Skull Valley Goshute Reservation would hold commercial irradiated nuclear fuel from nuclear reactors, whereas Yucca Mountain would be a burial site for both commercial and Department of Energy high-level nuclear waste, which would include waste from the nuclear weapons complex. So I guess that's one difference between the two dumps. Where Skull Valley used to be considered Plan B, Yucca Mountain is in such trouble these days that it's kind of hard to believe, but even nuclear industry voices are starting to point to Skull Valley as Plan A. And that's kind of disconcerting in its own right. For environmental justice reasons, this has got to be one of the worst forms of environmental racism, to dump the deadliest poisons ever created on a tiny, impoverished Indian reservation. It's frightening, but that dump is very much on a fast track, and the NRC commissioners could rule in the next couple weeks to allow that dump to go forward. But the state of Utah has indicated that they will appeal at every turn, and so if they lose at the NRC, they're going to appeal to the federal courts. And the environmental movement in the country and the environmental justice movement is really making its voice heard at this point. We have a group letter in opposition to the private fuel storage dump that has been signed by well over 300 organizations, and that represents millions of members across the United States. And I think it's fair to say that if they really tried to start shipping this stuff in 2007, like they're proposing, that there will be blockades at reactor sites. People are not going to let this waste be dumped on an Indian reservation.
We should mention that the tribe itself has voted to take the waste, no?
No, there's a tremendous split within the tribe. And in fact, there are two tribal councils in dispute with each other as to who actually is in authority. There is an organization on the reservation adamantly opposed to the dump. It's the traditionals of the tribe. And it's just an indication that high-level radioactive waste is not only radioactive poison, it's also social poison for the communities that get targeted. When the industry dangles $50 million or $200 million, the amount of money is secret, in front of a destitute community, then this kind of thing is unavoidable. And it's really shameful that the nuclear industry would do this.
That was Kevin Camps of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service based in Washington, D.C. For more information, call area code 202-328-0002 or visit the group's website at www.nirs.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.